This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
We are, as I mentioned at the beginning of the Ango, we're going to be looking at these verses in a number of different ways, through Teisho on Sundays, through session talks, through two of these evening sessions, through the Ango intensive, so that if things go as planned, we'll have completed, worked our way through all of the verses by the end of the Ango. Because quite a number of those ways in which I'll be presenting it will be in a way in which there's not back and forth like a Teisho, I thought tonight it might be good to, what I'd like to do is just say a few words, I think, about the second and third verse, one at a time, and then just open it up for questions and discussion, so that we use this as a time to engage more about this particular verse or what has come before, even though we're really at the beginning of this. So the first part of this, these verses, are called the preparation. And in a sense, you might think of it as preparing our environment or reflecting on our environment, recognizing that we are so, particularly in the beginning of practice, which lasts for years, that we are so affected by our environment, that what happens outside of us has a direct impact on what is happening in our mind, particularly as we go to the meditation seat, as we try to practice mindfulness and concentration. And so these initial teachings are just recognizing that and offering guidance for the practice of the bodhisattva on how to, in essence, help oneself and what to be aware of in our world that is going to, what are those things that will have real impact on us in terms of our practice. Another way of looking at this is from wherever you are, each of us are. So for lay practitioners or home dwellers, how do you hear these teachings? For those of us who are monastics living in this life, or for those of you who are here right now living this life, how do you hear these teachings? You can look at it that way. And we can also look at them in terms of how to understand each of these verses in terms of sort of how to practice, how to work with the things inside and outside. And we can also, in other words, from a more conventional understanding of things, and then we can also look at each of these verses from a more ultimate sense. Okay, so let's just look at this second verse. And there are different translations, as you know, with their commentaries. And I'm sort of drawing from these various, some of the various translations to put together the verse the way I like it, the way I think it speaks well. So it may not be exactly what you have. So the second verse is attached to your loved ones. You're stirred up like water. Hating your enemies, you burn like fire. In the darkness of confusion, you forget what to adopt and what to discard. Give up your homeland this is the practice of bodhisattvas. And so to think of this in terms of home, our native land, the place where we were born, the place where we are born all throughout the day, that place that is the most familiar to us, right? Like when we go home, if we have a family to go home to, particularly the place of our parents, then we're going back to that place in which so much of our coming into being happened. And I think we've all had the experience of going back and entering back into kind of becoming that person again in certain ways, sort of going back into that home within our mind of patterns and reactions and ways of seeing people. In the Transmission of the Light koan collection, there's a dialogue in which the teacher asks the student who's wanting to be ordained, are you leaving home physically or mentally? And the student says, actually, I'm leaving home physically. And the teacher says, what has the sublime truth of the Buddhas to do with body or mind? In other words, what is home leaving? What is giving up your homeland? And so what is home? So it's the place of our greatest attachments, those places in which we have great love, and those places in which we might have great hate or aversion. And so all that we love, we want to go towards it, we want to be close to it, we might want to protect it, take care of it, preserve it. We might want to possess it. And so how do we recognize in our love, in those things that we have that attraction towards, how do we recognize when it's love and when it's attachment? When we're caring for something or someone versus wanting something from something or someone? Are we able to recognize when we're loving someone or something for who or what they are versus what we want them to provide us, to give us? Can we see the difference between cherishing, truly cherishing someone, and wanting to possess something or someone? And encouraging, wanting to protect and encourage something to affirm its life versus wanting to control it or manage it. Those things that we dislike or hate tend to be just the opposite. We want to get away from them. We want to be distant. We might have resentment and bitterness. We might feel anger. We might want to hurt it or destroy it. We might want to extinguish it, a kind of banishment from our lives. And so in these loves and hates, we should think about all the different ways in which this occurs. So, you know, we might have an enemy for an instant when you're driving down the highway. Somebody who cuts you off, or somebody who is not sufficiently polite in a store, or somebody who walks by you and says something or does something. It might be a distant enemy. It might be a closer enemy, somebody, a neighbor, a coworker, somebody we come into contact with, but isn't in our intimate circle. Or it might be within our inner circle, a family member, a partner, a friend. And that all of those can be a moment or longer of love or hate. And of course, what is being discussed here or looked at here is the two ways in which we create suffering, through aversion and through attraction, loving and hating. And so what is happening in love and hate, right? How do we take that up as practitioners? What is it showing us about ourselves, about our karma, about our mind, about suffering, about happiness. When we are attracted to something, or when we're repelled by something, what does that have to do with the self? In other words, recognizing that the attraction is not in the object, it's not in the person, the repulsion is not in the object. What is it? What is the function in this way, in a samsaric sense, with love and hate? What is it providing us? Then he goes on to say, in the darkness of confusion, we forget what to adopt and discard. You know, often when people have an encounter with something that causes them to face death, or the imminent possibility of death, or they're dying, you know, oftentimes things become very clear. What was important isn't. And what is important becomes very, very clear, very immediate. But in the darkness of confusion, we forget. We forget what to adopt, what we should take up, and what we should let go of. And so to think about that in terms of the path, you know, what is the function of bodhicitta, of raising the bodhi mind? And what is that, what's involved in that, you know? If you think of what's happening when you raise motivation, when you raise the bodhi mind, when you bring forth aspiration, what's actually going on? Why is that important? And what does that, how does that tie in with what this verse is speaking to? What is that based in, that bodhicitta? Right? In a sense, whenever we have any kind of aspiration or intention, that's based in something. It's not just an intention that's hanging in midair, right? It's connected to something. An intention is just an expressed desire, a commitment, a vow, is an articulated, expressed desire. Based in what? Right? What's the basis for that intention? What's it connected to? And then in our confusion, what is it that gets lost? What actually happens in a state of confusion? What happens when our mind is distracted? You know, we use these words and we relate to them. We all have experienced distraction. We have been distracted. But have we experienced distraction? We have expressed intention, but have we actually examined an intention? Right. What is actually going on there? Why is that so emphasized? Why is that cultivated and encouraged in practice? When we become confused, caught in those extremes of loving and hating, aversion and grasping, what comes into view? What becomes important at those moments? And what ceases to be important? What are we adopting? And what are we discarding? Remember, each of these verses ends with, this is the practice of bodhisattvas. Right? So what each of these verses is addressing is, in a sense, essential instruction for what a bodhisattva does, how we live, how we practice. And then, give up your homeland, the last line. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. And so what does that mean? How do you relate to that? How do you understand that as essential instruction for the bodhisattva path? Okay, so I think I'll just leave it at that for now. And see what you think about all this. So you out there, if you raise your hand, your Zoom hand, because we may not see you on screen if you just raise your hand on screen, because we have more than one screen to see all of you. So if you raise your Zoom hand, Laurel will bring you up. And then those of you who are here in the room.
I'm thinking about, being here and like part of the idea of being, of coming to a monastery, I think is to leave home and to like kind of get away from, in some ways to step away from the things that get your goat, I think it's also possible, if you're making a life here, or even if you're just here for a long time. I mean, I feel like I've experienced this where it's like, this is in some ways become a home. Not even in some ways, it is a home. And so it's like, I've made new, I'm stuck in the same ways and in different ways. Mm-hmm. And related to like sort of like leaving home, what if there's like so many things where like I see like I need to let this go and I am not doing it, and I like there's a big part of me that just doesn't want to, and like I know that I should, but like I can't right now. I don't know.
So recognizing that coming here, this becomes, particularly the longer you stay, becomes a new home, which means a place in which new things become familiar, right? Things that for which there was no sort of habit becomes more habitual, right? We develop new habits, which aren't, in and of themselves problematic. That's important to understand, that because we do something over and over, and that there's less need to, make it happen. We just do it. So in the beginning, maybe when the alarm clock goes off in the morning, there was more of a struggle. And then there's a certain point where there's no struggle. You just get up. So is that gaining freedom, or is that just developing a new habit? The question is, really, is it helping you? And to whatever degree it is a habit, how is that binding? But what it makes clear is that the place is not the place where the habit lives, right? Because otherwise you could leave wherever you were and you would be free of all of those habits, right? So clearly that's not true. So you say you see things that you should let go of and you don't. And so, are there times where you see that you don't want to? And also, are there times where you see that you feel like you do want to and you're trying to let go, but it's not dropping away? Both of those can happen. Both of those do happen. And that's important. So it's really important to recognize when we don't actually want to let go. There's a part of us that is trying to or is practicing as though, but then we realize we don't really, we really aren't ready or don't want to drop this yet. We don't have faith in that. The Buddha said, in being asked about that by somebody, he said, we don't let go as long as we still believe in it, that it's going to provide us whatever we need from it in that moment. And then sometimes you really do want to release yourself, and you are trying to the best of your ability, but it's just still seems to be lingering. And that's just because the sort of the karmic energy of that, the bond that you have with that in that moment is not yet exhausted, right? And so that when we do let go of something, whether it's significant or small, the fact that it drops away is because in that moment, that thread of karmic attachment has been dissolved, has been released. Even though at a deeper level, it may still remain, right? So it may still arise. But in that moment, something has been, has shifted. Otherwise, it would still remain. And so just to recognize that both of those can be functioning. And one, it sort of directs your attention to where the attention needs to be. So one is really working on, why do you not want to let go, right? And the other is recognizing you're doing all that you know how to do in terms of what practice is, so maybe you just need to be patient, right? And recognize this just is going to take some time that you're not in complete control of. Yeah.
So when I look at the first two lines, I'm reminded of much of my life in my 20s and early 30s. And it's a good memory. Those were good learning experiences. And when I get to the third line, I do notice that that comes back up. But when it talks about giving up your homeland, I don't at all think of it as a place. When I first read that, the way that I related to it as feeling totally normal, it was because it's giving up your psychological self. So you're not subject to either of the first two. And I always have to go back there because that's like where I first started being able to witness my reactions, even though it's not language that we use or that I've used more recently. So my question is, like, when we know that, like, being a person or what we call a home position is conditioned mind, and that we can get both under that and a more objective view on that by not identifying with a psychological self or the content of consciousness, how then, I mean, you just explained it to Vito, so I'm not even sure why I'm still asking, but how do you work with this karma that keeps coming up of the confusion of forgetting what to adopt and discard? Because that, like, brings it back into some sort of a duality of choosing.
That's, and we're recognizing that we need to make choices. And so there are things that we if to help ourselves and guided by the Dharma and sort of reflecting on our own experience and what we've seen through our experience, we hopefully more and more are able to make wise choices about things that will help us, will serve us, and things that won't. Even as we recognize that the, you know, the power is not in the object, but we have a bond with that object, whether it be a person or a place or a thing. You know, why is it that some thoughts arise in the mind and they stay right on the surface, they don't go in deep at all, and you just let them go and it's done. And others are so persistent. Right? Each thought is just a thought. It has its own nature, which is the same. So its the nature of one thought is no more powerful than the other. It's the same. It actually has no inherent power. But why do we experience it so differently? That's what we call our karma, you know, that is... and so the stronger we experience something, what we're seeing is the stronger that bond is, which means the more challenging it will be to release it, which means also the stronger investment we have in it, and so on. So we do need to choose. We need to recognize, you know, that's what I was talking about before in terms of understanding that to the degree that we do understand this and we can exert some choices and control over our environment, we can make things easier for ourselves. We can actually create a more conducive outer environment that will be more conducive to cultivating our inner environment, to speak of it that way. So why not? Wouldn't it be good to do that? And particularly in the beginning, and again, the beginning can mean years, and generally does, while we're developing our stability, which means through mindfulness, through concentration, mentally, emotionally, physically, in all ways, energetically developing our stability, because in the beginning we don't have a lot of that. And so we get very easily set off by almost everything, you know, to different degrees. And so, and that's why we spend so much time in distractedness, and we have to spend so much time coming back. And that's what changes. And that's what we're trying to change, is that lack of stability, because in that lack of stability, we're very reactive, right? Which means it's very hard to actually see what's happening and recognize where that there, the power isn't out there. It's not something that's happening to me that therefore I am reacting to, like, you know, a defensive reaction against an assault where something is happening to me. But within a very sort of confined mind, a very distracted mind, a very reactive mind, that's exactly what it can seem like, is that something's happening to me. And so by really paying attention to you know, our outer environment to the degree that we can sort of work with that instability, and to try and calm it, you know, and make it easier for us to just do our basic practice and more easily, more readily facilitate the development of those qualities of our mind that we all possess, but that have not been well trained. Kenja?
So I was wondering whether we can go a little bit deeper in a way, what to do, how to leave the homeland, because it makes completely sense the first time I read the verse. Yes, it makes sense to me that it is necessary to leave the homeland to address the three poisons. But then I started to think about it. How do you really do it? Is it Zazen? Are there other skillful means to leave?
What are you calling the homeland?
It's my habitual patterns of thinking, my mind, my ego.
So do you know how those came to be developed? But what is actually happening when something is on the path to becoming a habit? What's actually Well, so something happens, let's say for the first time, and you respond, right? Just shooting from the hip, you respond. And you get some result, which is okay, right? Sort of handled that situation. So when that comes up again, right? Or something very similar to that, right? We respond again. So now we have a little bit of history to draw upon. Right, and then we do it again and again. Remember what happens within the understanding of the skandhas. At first, there's something, and then there's contact, there's sensation, and then we begin to understand it, and then there's mental formations. Right, so we're developing our actions, our strategies, based in the perceptions, our understanding of what's happening. And so, in the beginning, we may just react, or it may be a more thoughtful response. But as it goes on, through more repetition, it becomes more habitual. We don't have to think so much, which is very neat, right? Because we have to expend much less energy, you know, mental energy, and we just respond the way we have before, which is very sort of energy efficient in the moment, but not always in terms of the consequence. Right, because sometimes the consequence is not really that great, and it takes a lot of work to deal with that. But my point is the repetition over and over again. So when we're in, so first we have to recognize. So he says we forget what to adopt and discard as though we know, but we have forgotten. So first we have to know. Right, we can't forget something we don't know. And so first we have to learn and recognize what is it that we should be adopting? What is it that we should be discarding? So the Dharma provides us with a sort of humanic, you know, sort of historical perspective on that based on the way people work. And then, and so the Dharma says, you know, when you are greedy, or when you're stingy, or when you act out of your anger, when you're, you know, let your attachments fly, that such and such is likely to happen, almost certainly going to happen. But you don't know that. Let's say you don't know that. So you test it, right? Which is why mindfulness is so important. So we're actually paying attention to what's happening. We're not just acting out of a different script. And so we see for ourselves whether something is actually effective. And then in a sense, that begins to be repeated, right? Shantideva says anything can become easier or more familiar with repetition. And so that can happen in a way that is binding, you know, and sort of perpetuating samsara, or it can be done in a way that is releasing. And what's the difference? Because you could say both are habits, right? But what makes the difference as to whether something is more liberating or something is more binding? To shout it out. Right, but if you just think of two actions, you know, that have become sort of habitual in the sense that, you know, that's just a natural response. What makes something sort of binding in its habit versus something that's more liberating? Why is it more liberating?
Awareness.
Mindfulness, one, right? Without the mindfulness, the habit, I mean, it might be something that's okay, something that's good, but we're not really, we may not be really learning anything or understanding anything because there's no mindfulness. But within mindfulness, there's also a sense of morality, or a sense of what is skillful and not skillful. The Buddha called it ardency. And so it's also that the basis of the action is based in something that's fundamentally skillful, like, or virtuous or moral, versus something that's not. Okay. Go on.
Looking at the two first verses, you know, a few weeks ago, we drove out to some relative's house for kind of a get-together, and driving into the cul-de-sac, probably about 16 homes, every single home had a Trump sign in front of it, including our relatives who were there to visit. And these are people I know and love, I respect them, but at the same time, they're actively endorsing something that I think is doing a lot of harm and causing suffering. And I was struggling with, how do I reconcile that? You know, looking at these people that I know, and having those conflicting feelings about attachment. I love them. I do care for them. But at the same time, I feel a lot of aversion and anger about what they're helping to perpetuate.
So how did you reconcile that?
Well, I, you know, basically didn't talk about politics. And, you know, made sure that we're just there for the occasion to celebrate, or there to celebrate, you know, high school graduation. And made sure that when they reached out to shake my hand, I said, listen, I'm just going to touch elbows, because everybody there, they were like, what's the problem? You know, no mask, shaking hands, you know, we're the only ones not, you know, keeping our distance. So, and they know, I mean, it's like, you know, it was almost like it was unspoken. We know which tribe we're in, kind of, but kind of kept the peace. So just avoided any conflict. But still, it's not resolved. I mean, it's, you know, I'm still struggling with that. And it's personal to me. That's what makes it so tough. You know, it's not what I read in the news alone. It's people I know and love, and I don't understand it.
So one way of looking at it, as you said it, is that, you know, there are the people, you know, the people that you love, and then there are their beliefs, you know, their political beliefs.
Yep. Right.
And to recognize that they're clearly related, but they're also not exactly the same thing.
Right. Yeah. And I thought of something you said to me a while ago. You said, you know, you said when you talked about Donald Trump one time, it's like, so it helps you sometimes think of him as a child. So I remember that. Sometimes it helps me to think of these, when people are them having trouble with in terms of their beliefs and what they're espousing and advocating, just to try to think of them not as the other, but think of somebody who I love, but also in a way as children. And it helps me think about it differently, think of them differently.
Is that just putting yourself in a superior position?
Could be, yeah. But it's also just a way for me to deal with it in a way that I don't get carried away with. I feel more than I've felt in a long time, I mean, maybe ever. I'm really worried. I'm really concerned about what's going on. And I've felt anger and anxiety that I haven't felt in a long, maybe ever, about just the way things are. So part of it is just, how do I deal with that in a way that doesn't get sucked into something negative?
Yeah, so I think to recognize that getting sucked in, as you say, is not going to change anybody's mind.
No.
Might just reinforce it. But at the same time, to not just, you know, become indifferent, you know, or pretend that nothing's happening or that it doesn't matter. And so one is to conflate, you know, the belief with the person, and as though any person's belief about one thing is all that they are, right? That, in other words, to reduce them to just a belief or an attitude about something. Right. And so sometimes to, you know, to see them and to see what else they are, you know, and knowing them, you know, to know what else they are in terms of what do they love that is good? What do they do that is good, you know, else in their life? And also, you know, well, how did you come to believe what you believe? How'd that happen?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it's not an easy answer. I mean, look, it's a...
How did you come to believe what you believe?
Through just my whole life of conditioning and reflecting, kind of a mixture of both, you know, socialization, heredity, but also reflection, contemplation, all those things combined.
So a lot of things that were going on inside of you, right? And you could think of as your person, your personality, your inclination, you know, things that you might have been born with and then you, you know, were either predisposed to or maybe were encouraged, you know, in the particular life that you had growing up. And then the you know, environment that you grew up in, and then, you know, if you take that same sort of combination of ingredients and put it into different places, you know, into a different person, into a different family, into a different region, into a different, you know, still there are families where, you know, siblings grow up and can be very different from each other.
Yeah.
You know, they're very different views. So, you know, that doesn't explain it all. But right. Just to realize, you know, that it is constructed, you know, you weren't just born with all of your attitudes and beliefs, you know, they were built. And I imagine they make sense to you, right? They seem right to you. Your views.
Yeah, most of the time. But I also don't try to hold on to them too tightly. Because they change. They do change, you know. I do encounter other beliefs and thoughts and teachings that make me reconsider. So they're not totally static.
You know, Jonathan Haidt in the book, The Righteous Mind, said, I think I'm remembering this reasonably well, that, you know, if you just sort of take conservatives and liberals as just two groups, that they, you know, that sort of generally speaking, there are certain values that are held up in high regard in one group and different values that are held up in the other group, which are not necessarily, you know, completely contradictory. But within those values, then there are also certain belief systems about how to bring those values forward. And that it's those two things in combination that are really different within different sort of ideological groups, you know. So rather than it's, you know, these people are the good ones and these people are the bad ones, that it's really different worldviews, you know, different views of of how they see things, we see things going on, what we think is important to be emphasizing, and then how do we go about doing that, you know? Yeah. So, and I think that's, you know, that can be helpful. It can also be a way of, you know, glossing over the significance of those differences and, you know, sort of coming to a relativistic perspective. Well, everybody's got their own view and every view is equal. And it's not, right? Certainly not in terms of their impact, you know, their consequence. And so, so Zongpo says, well, give up your homeland. And so one way of dealing with that is to distance yourself, right? Be like Milarepa, have no home, have no family, right? So that's one way of dealing with it, right?
Well, you mean leaving? It means like cutting off ties? Is that, what's that called, gaslighting or something, or what?
No, no, just leaving. In other words, like Milarepa, you know, had no family, never stayed anywhere, you know. So a more sort of externalized and sort of extreme view of that would be to not have any connections. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, there are, you know, over the years I've talked to, you know, a lot of students, a lot of people who have family struggles, you know, struggles with a family member or with family, where, you know, there's a lot of tension and anger and sometimes hatred. And that, you know, watching students sometimes try and try and try and try all different ways, you know, very sincerely of trying to ameliorate or to sort of calm or to, you know, work with, to address, and sometimes with not a lot of success. And so sometimes what people do is kind of what I just said. They kind of give up their home. They give up their family for a while. So they might literally not have contact. And I'm not advising this. I'm just saying, you know, that sometimes people are driven to, when they recognize that staying in this relationship just continually creates negative binding karmic patterns, that despite all of their efforts, they can't seem to shift or break. That sometimes what they consciously choose to do is just a kind of time out. You know, and just say, for a while, I'm just not going to have contact. You know, it's not a very satisfying approach. You know, it doesn't feel like it's a good sort of bodhisattva action, you know. But to do that as a way to try and, you know, step it down, you know, to try and take some of that charged energy out or try and just create some space to find maybe are there different ways that might be helpful over time. And so, because there are teachings, you'll see teachings where you know, the encouragement is, you know, don't have any friends, don't have anything in your life that you can attach to, right? Or recognize those things that are really foster attachment, right? Those things that we really do love and care about, right? Because they're going to bring forth attachments, right? And so, you know, from the Mahayana perspective, that seems like a very dualistic practice, right? To just cut that off, and in a way, it is, right? And so that, I'm not advocating for that, but I'm speaking about that because it actually does happen in people's lives sometimes, where that's what they choose to do or are driven to do, and also because you'll see it in the teachings, and so it's how to understand that, you know. Because it can seem counter to what the whole Bodhisattva vow is about.
Right. Right, yeah. Thank you.
Yes, okay. Well, so in the, this may be a related question, the Dogo Kyentse Rinpoche translation says, "In my native land, waves of attachment to friends and kin surge." And has the framing to abandon my native land is the practice of a bodhisattva. And I guess, like the first time I read it, my assumption was actually like more so that it was about like sort of nation than, like we've been talking about homeland in a sort of more symbolic way as like your place of comfort or karmic rootedness. But, I don't know. I'm curious, like, if there is a helpful way to understand this verse as also like giving some advice about how to sort of relate to, being part of like a nation or a place or a group in that way.
Well, first, I think it's, you know, historically, generally speaking, about family, you know, as being the sort of dominant social structure in a person's life historically. So you think of the Buddha leaving home, Jesus leaving home, you know, these where, you know, in times and still today, where family, you know, was like a major, the major sort of determining factor and influencing factor in a person's life, more than country or, you know, a nation is just a human creation, an idea. And whether it's a nation or it's a state or it's a county or it's a town or it's a sangha, you know, they're just different ways of sort of drawing a boundary, which can be a boundary of inclusion, you know, a boundary of, you know, mutual relatedness, or it can be a boundary that, you know, excludes. And, you know, so often it's both, but sometimes one comes to the fore. And so I think, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, if it's skillful, then use it. When it's not skillful, it should be abandoned. You know, if it's not skillful, if that idea is no longer helping, then it should be abandoned or retooled or, you know, re-understood or something, to go through some change so that it becomes helpful again. Yeah. Karen?
I was listening to the discussion when Kokuan was talking, and I thought verse 3 kind of answered the dilemma of unfavorable places being abandoned, and the disturbing emotions will gradually fade. And then the rest of the whole verse kind of reflected what we were discussing. The only part I question is to rely on solitude. That's the hard part, because you can't go live in a cave. But I do think kind of taking a break can bring up the better emotions. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, let's look at that with that lead in by you. Thank you. Let's look at that verse. So, giving up negative places and objects, mental afflictions or disturbing emotions gradually decrease. With no distractions, virtuous activities naturally increase. When the mind becomes clear, then confidence and certainty in the Dharma arises. To cultivate solitude is the practice of a bodhisattva. So again, similar to the previous verse, this is just acknowledging how affected we are by the world around us, by things, by people, by situations, by places, and that effect can be both either disturbing and agitating and, you know, creating doubt and confusion, or it can be settling and helping us to build confidence and cultivating the mind. And so, again, it's just recognizing that while ultimately we're aspiring to be free of to be free within all things and people and emotions and thoughts and everything we encounter, that that for a long time we're not free, right? We get blown around and impacted by what's happening, and then that feeds directly into, you know, more, you know, like sitting on the cushion and doing meditation, or being able to just sit and read a text and not be distracted, or to be able to listen to someone while they're talking and actually pay attention. So it actually has direct impact on how we are living. And so what these verses are just pointing out the things that particularly hook us. And then if we look at, well, if that's hooking us, then what if we sort of shift that and create something different or turn that in a different way? Then can we use that same sort of dynamic of person, place, thing, situation to our benefit while we are developing our stability? So that as time goes on, we're less and less dependent on or needing to be doing that, right? So Vimalakirti is sort of like the ultimate example of the practitioner who could go, he could go to all the places you're not supposed to go, right? All the places that are, you know, samsara and where Mara hangs out and, you know, that, you know, you're going to get hooked, and could go there and not lose himself, not forget what to adopt and what to avoid. And so we really, remember, this is the preparation part of the text. So it's really about recognizing how, you know, because we're so easily influenced, well, why don't we use that to our advantage, right? Why don't we influence ourselves in good ways, right, to make it work easier? And so the path of gaining stability is really what we're talking about in the mind, in the body, and emotions, and recognizing that no thing is inherently bad. No thing is inherently obstructive, right? Nothing possesses the power to do that in and of itself, that it's more in our experience of it. And that's true for everything outside and everything inside. And so again, when it is very strong, that's our karma, that's our experience of it. That's our view of it, our understanding of it. And so that's just showing us the strength of our attachments or the strength of our identification in terms of our self. And so to in ways that we can, that are not, it's not about denying our lives or cutting people and things out. But it is, you know, we make lots and lots of choices about where we put our energy, what we bring in to the homeland, and what we don't, right? We're making choices about that all the time. And so some of those things we don't have a lot of choice over, but a lot of things we do. And so it's being more skillful, more cognizant, more conscious, mindful of that. And so then to think about daily zazen, about sesshin, about residential training, about hermitage as places, right, that where you are intentionally creating a very conducive environment, whether it's for a period, whether it's for a week, whether it's for a period of a more extended training, to enter into a sort of a very deliberate environment, right, where you're minimizing a lot of those influences so that you can really develop that stability. So that when we then leave that place and go to a place where there's more activity, there's more happening, we have more ground, right? There's more capacity to enter into that and not become undone. With no distractions, virtuous activities naturally increase. So the other side of that is when we are distracted, it's much easier to act non-virtuously, which means basically unskillfully. Why? Because we're more susceptible, right? When we're distracted, we're less in contact with our basic mind, with our stability, with our intention, with our aspiration. We forget, right? We forget what we have adopted. We forget our intentions, we forget our vows, we forget our practice, and then we act on that. And the more distracted we are, the faster things move, right? Which means the less time we have to actually recognize what's happening before we respond, until the response is not a response, it's just a reaction, it's a habit. We're not even aware that we've made a choice. And so in that, we become very vulnerable, very sort of fragile to our conditioning, to our sort of the more negative aspects of our karma. Whereas when the situation is, we perceive it as slower, simpler, it's easier to see what's happening, right, out here, in here, then it's easier, then we are naturally more mindful. We're naturally more aware of what's happening. We see our emotions arising. We see what thoughts are arising. We see that we are going to respond, and we see that there are different ways that we could respond, right? And we actually can make choices. And so then he says, when the mind becomes clear, confidence and certainty in the Dharma arises. And so I think of, we begin in faith, we practice, and then we verify. And so when we see that happening, we recognize, oh, I just responded in a different way. That situation did not go the way it went in a different way than it would have gone before. And that builds our confidence, which is a really good thing, right? It feels like, you know, you're taking ownership of something that actually belongs to you now. And you see that you are the sort of active master in helping to cultivate that. So that tends to give us more faith, you know, give us more encouragement to continue that. And so then he concludes, to cultivate solitude is the practice of a bodhisattva. And so there again, there's these moments in training and practice where we enter into some degree of seclusion. So in the Zendo, you're secluded on your cushion. And that's actually important. You know, there are monitors there who are there specifically to take care of things. You don't have to do that unless you're a monitor, right? And so if you're there sitting on your cushion, getting into everybody else's business, you know, you're not taking care of them or yourself, right? In other words, that mat is your place of seclusion, your place of solitude, right? And that doesn't mean that you're trying to block everybody out, you know, and it doesn't, that also doesn't go against the feeling of being connected, you know, feeling like you are joined with the Sangha. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about where we really are distracting ourselves from that solitude, that seclusion, which may just be a habit, you know, of being, you know, we're all out here, you know, kind of managing, trying to manage what's happening, rather than trusting that we can, that in this moment, everybody's fine. They can take care of themselves. I can take care of myself. And then into more extended periods of solitude. That's why I think, you know, solitude and seclusion is a part of our tradition. And in cultures, in a culture where that is not valued, you know, in the monastics meeting this morning, we were talking about honesty. And what does it mean to be a community that really rests within the virtue of honesty, right? And mutual trust. That if we lose that, we really don't have much left. And then to think of, so that that's sort of a primary foundation that allows us to do this. And then to do that within a culture that has enshrined dishonesty, right? And deceit, open deceit, and an open lack of trust, like cultivating that. You know, what kind of recipe is that? And so when these virtues, these qualities that are considered very important in Buddhist practice are not considered important in our culture or in our family or in our circle or in our relationships with people at home, that's part of our environment. Right, and that's going to be part of what we have to work out. You know, when we value something that somebody else doesn't, they don't understand it, right? Then how do we ensure that we have, you know, can have that for ourselves because it's so necessary, without it becoming a division? Daniel?
Yeah, so I've been actually, I keep mulling over that first part of the line, at least in the PDF translation of when unfavorable places are abandoned. And I think of, you know, the origin of this you know, they didn't have the internet, right? They didn't have a globally wired planet. And in this day and age, it just feels like kind of like the earlier comment about like the high school party, the graduation party, and seeing a, you know, block full of Trump supporters. You know, like, it's like, where can you abandon to, you know? It seems like there's less, because even if you go to a small town, if you go to, you know, a small town in the Catskills, there still are people, you know, spreading conspiracies that they read on Reddit or something. And it seems like there's so much less refuge space. And then that means like, well, how do we confront our current Buddhist reality of this, the very tricky skillfulness that we're all so sort of, you know, have a gap with in terms of digital, you know, what's the digital skillfulness? So many of the way all these tools that are created are not necessarily made with all these things in mind. And so I keep going back to this over and over again of, you know, the almost like there's a situation now to confront this, to not abandon, you know, that to do so would actually cause a lot of suffering.
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, I mean, I don't know what it was like to live in any other time. But that, you know, when your world was, you know, the bulk of your world was what you could see, you know, and touch or travel to, you know, in some day's time. And that, which meant most of the world, people didn't know anything about, you know, most people perhaps. And so then what that influence was of environment, and it's not that it was always good by any means, but that it was more, you know, what's in front of you. And that, you know, so for the Buddha to, you know, have been raised within this, his home where all of his family and, you know, servants and within the town and all of that, you know, that the dusts of the world, and that he could just walk out the door and go into the forest, you know, and sort of leave that. And that we are, you know, we have had this thrust upon us where there really is no escape. You know, there's no turning off. Even when you turn off, you know, there's a sense that there's so much happening that it's hard to even, you know, let it, you know, drop out of our mind. And particularly now, because there are so many things of such magnitude, and that, you know, that it's not just a localized or a, you know, a sort of specific thing, either in time or place, but it's sort of blown apart every boundary, you know, that it's everywhere and it's all of time. Right? It's the rest of time. And so it's sort of like we're needing to evolve very quickly, you know, in our capacity just for our beloved minds to be able to hold that, you know. And then as practitioners who are actually, you know, really spending a lot of time really entering into that mind and seeing the impact, you know, and feeling the impact of that is not a small thing. And so I think what it means for practice, you know, that's why, you know, traditionally you go to a place where you're not stimulated, right? Where you're not constantly being stimulated so that you can just work with that, all your own sort of karmic stimulation and find your ground, as I said before, and then you step forth and really, I don't know, you know, unless that it's like, we also are bringing that into our work, you know, through the Beyond Fear work and the, you know, environmental justice work and working in prisons. I mean, we're going, putting ourselves in places and bringing in that agitation, which traditionally wasn't what monasteries did, right? I feel like we need to because it's here. You know, it's not something that is happening somewhere else. and it is, you know, it's part of our work. And yet it is, how do we do that in a way that we don't just become everything else and sort of lose, you know, or forget, you know, what needs to be adopted, what do we need to be doing, and what do we need to create within our lives to be able to make that happen? Because nobody else is going to do that. You know, unless people are very lucky, their work, their social structures, there are not going to be encouraging them to do that. You know, in a certain sense, we have to value our inner life, you know, as you know, in the way that we value our outer life. And we don't. I mean, in our society, we don't. I mean, I think that's just, except for individuals, that is a very clear non-priority. And so so that I think is another reason why Sangha is so important, you know, to gain the support and the sort of the mutual strength to do that and know that you're not crazy, that that's not only valid, but it's necessary, really, if we're going to make it. And also that it doesn't mean forsaking anything. John?
Thank you. Maybe the conversation has moved beyond, but I just remember many, many years ago when I was in residence, I was fortunate enough to go to a Zazen Kai at Greenhaven. And I remember afterwards sort of marveling at how challenging that environment was, just the unfavorable circumstances for practice, and the favorable circumstances in which I was in. And I remembered you said something along the lines of, it's not about making it as difficult as possible. And I just, these first few verses sort of remind me of that, of just that idea that you can step away from these things, as you're saying, in a way, because that stability is so, you know, it's just not present. And that by, you know, it may be just simply too difficult without, you know, staying in those unfavorable circumstances, it might be too difficult. Obviously, for those practitioners, they didn't have choice. Those were their circumstances. But I just thought of that and thought, you know, it's okay to recognize I can practice that, but I don't know if I can get anywhere with it because it's just it hooks you too much, or it's too challenging.
You know, and what's interesting is that they did exactly what we're talking about within the prison, which is a not very conducive environment in certain ways. The administration fought it. The chaplains fought it. A lot of the other inmates fought it. You know, they were the minority in a big way. And they were not accepted in a big way. So there was a lot of pushback and obstacles thrown up to their establishing of that first group at Greenhaven. But on the other hand, that became their conducive environment because it was so difficult. For them, the question of life and death was never abstract, right? They woke up to it every day. And they would say that. You know, for them, nothing about that was a luxury, was dispensable. And that then in wanting to practice, they did everything they could to create a conducive environment. And so they created a zendo, which for the time that it was there, was a refuge, right? Even though it's the same cinder block, linoleum floor room that it was, you know, that they created a zendo and transformed it into a place of practice, and such that as they continued to go into it week after week after week after week, just as the zendo here, you know, creates a kind of power for us. The more experience we have within it, right? It becomes a sacred space. That the same thing happened to them. So they were really functioning under the same kinds of, you know, understandings. And then they were also doing that by being together as a Sangha, right? And creating the community of practitioners within the prison itself. So, you know, they were just working with what they had, right? Which is what we do. Work with what we have. Yeah. Sure. And we can come back to John if he was next up.
I wanted to ask about a part actually of the commentary, Dogo Khyentse's commentary. Mm-hmm. First, you know, he translates that in the very beginning, the opening verses that we have chanted, we haven't really spent much time on, but anyway, that opening, Namo Lokeshvara, as I pay homage to you, the Lord of the universe. And then he speaks about this Lord of the universe is Avalokiteshvara, and Avalokiteshvara is compassion itself. And then later, on 51, there's this line where he says, Avalokiteshvara's compassion knows no barrier or delay. His compassionate activity is effortless and spontaneous. Even a fresh summer breeze is the activity of the Buddhas. And I wanted to know how you understood that.
Share that with you after you tell me how you understand it.
Well, you know, that part about like Avalokiteshvara, the Lord of the universe, compassion is kind of like the heart. When I look at myself and my own experience as far as I can, you know, feel into like me and like what is sort of like the, like, you know, what's the Lord of this universe or the universe as far as I can experience it, meaning what's the most powerful, what's the sort of most strongest, most benevolent, I don't know, force. It feels like it is that unconditional love. And I feel like, you know, I'm drawn to spiritual practice because I know that like what's true about the sphere of my own body and mind is only a drop, you know, in the scheme of the universe. And so I feel like, okay, so I have some point of reference for understanding that teaching. But then the part about like Avalokiteshvara always responds without like delay, without barrier, and even a fresh summer breeze is the activity of the Buddhas. I'm like, is that a way, is that like a trained mind? Is that like someone who like has like learned to understand the world not through like science and not through, you know, some other avenue, but like as like the compassionate sort of activity, like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's a good question, and I don't, you know, I don't have a definitive answer to that. The way I look at that is that Avalokiteshvara is, you know, the manifestation of wisdom. It's the arms and legs of wisdom. It's there's the body of the wind, and there's the function of the wind, right? There's a koan, right, that you may recall, that asks exactly that question. There is the body of Avalokiteshvara, and there is the function of Avalokiteshvara. Both are essential, and they're unified. And in training, we engage and enter into and realize and bring forth both of those bodies. And so, but if you think of Avalokiteshvara as the manifestation of compassion, what is compassion? It's non-harming, and it's been a benefit. And so in that way, a fresh summer breeze, or a blade of grass, or a glance, or a touch, you know, or an object, a paper bag, could bring into someone's experience some experience of non-harming and of benefit. And in that, what I hear him saying is that's the manifestation of both the body and the functioning of Avalokiteshvara in that moment. That it's not, sometimes it takes a form that looks so much like you. And sometimes it takes a form that looks like something quite different. Sometimes it, so he says it's, it knows no barrier or delay. So I read that as a, you know, kind of an expression of a sort of fully perfected manifestation, right? That may be very versed in ways of the world, but that it's so integrated, you know, that it's just comes out as spontaneity. In the way that it's said that the Buddha no longer really operated under intention, you know, because intention requires thought and desire, right, and sort of a basis, and that the Buddha had, you know, sort of passed beyond that and was just a pure manifestation of Buddha Dharma, of wisdom. And so I see that as, and you know, those many expressions of a kind of fully perfected, just to sort of, you know, bring into our imagination, our conceptual mind of, so I may never, will likely never be a fully perfected expression of Avalokiteshvara in function. I already am in body, as are you. But can I aspire towards that effortlessness? What does that mean, right? How is that not, how am I unnecessarily effortful to move towards that spontaneity? Where do I hesitate or get stuck? And so to use it in that way, you know. Mr. Bruno.
By the way, there's so many Johns. I'm taking my line of darkness of stupidity, not caring what adopt or avoid. And it brings the idea of not carrying your baggage with you somewhere else. The idea that you leave the problem and now it's gone. Because if you don't find a skillful way to function, then you're just going to pick up new baggage. You're going to pick up the same, that you'll be fooled by the idea that you left home and now it's better, but you'll just, if you don't find the skill to discern between the two, you're just going to pick up, you're likely to pick up new baggage.
Yeah, I think the, you know, that's where the analogy, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think there's truth in it. I think that's where the analogy with baggage falls a little short, because a bag, or maybe not. I mean, you could leave a bag somewhere, right? And never go back to that place again, but the bag still exists, right? And because you put it there, you still have a relationship with it. Right, that will never end. It may not be very present in your consciousness, but it's there, because those experiences, those impressions, those seeds don't disappear, right? Because they are not a thing. And I think the relevance for practice is that those habit patterns, the things that we're, those disturbing emotions, the things that bind us, thinking of them as things that are binding us, that have power, then wanting to be distant from them makes sense, right? If I can get as far away as possible, then they'll have less and less impact on me. But when I realize that the power of that bondage is in my mind, and that I take that with me wherever I go, then the emphasis turns, begins to shift away from the object, whether it's a person or a situation or a thing, and more towards mind. And in particular, the mind's response, the mind's arising in the presence of that object, whether it's literally in front of me or whether it's a memory or whether it's something that's more dormant that I'm not aware of but still has some influence. And so that we don't have to worry about, you know, whether something will ever arise again. You know, have I finally conquered this? It's sort of that mentality. Because then we're living in fear, you know, of what if. But rather just the more we understand it and the more we've transformed or freed ourselves in its arising, one, it will be much less likely to arise, and two, when it does, it's not the same. And so that's why in the faith mind, the author says, when, you know, things no longer offend us, they cease to exist in the old way. He doesn't say they cease to exist. They just don't exist in the old way. And I remember hearing that early in training and thinking, that's not quite cutting it. Like, I don't want it to exist at all, right? I want a total, right, solution here. Because it felt that not existing in the old way somehow still seemed bound, right? That because it was based in this view that it's all or nothing, that I'm completely free, I'm not free at all, right? That the power is out there. And so that everything then becomes a potential threat, right? Which is why from that view, we go to war with ourselves, right? We go to war and fight those things within us that we're trying to subdue or extinguish or eradicate, right? But all we're doing is going to war, right? And actually just, you know, what happens when you attack the enemy? The enemy reinforces, right? It gets larger.
So I have been thinking a lot about the idea and phrase of and phrase used in these stanzas of abandonment and of leaving things and people that are a hindrance to you in your bodhisattva path. And I've been thinking about, you know, how, you know, as the Buddha put it, wandering alone like a rhinoceros would it feels like it can cause a lot of harm to other people, and doing so is this selfish for my own walking of this path, or is this something that will ultimately bring benefit to other people? And how can I do this in a way that doesn't cause harm, or that causes as little harm as possible?
And that's why I think it's so important to look at this together, is because it's easy to interpret it in certain ways. It seems to be encouraging you to cut things out of your life, regardless of the consequence, you know, that your seclusion, your solitude, you know, your liberation is what matters most. And so that's why at the beginning I said, you know, there are different ways we can look at this depending on what we might need or what would be helpful. And other ways we might not want to look at it because that's not going to be helpful. And so it may be that, you know, in studying this, it helps us to reflect on, are there things or people or circumstances in my life that really aren't healthy? You know, they're not healthy for me. Maybe they're not healthy for other people too. And so, and that happens sometimes in practice, you know, whereas a person is changing in their way of looking at themselves and thinking about things, reflecting on, you know, what is important and what is not important. Sometimes things that, you know, were more important to them just naturally fall away. They don't have to fall away with a, you know, with a dagger, But just there's just the energy that you used to have for that, or the enthusiasm or the interest, just you just see it shifting, you know. Sometimes it might be more deliberate because there might still be attraction, but you realize this is really not, you know, you're just having a different view of it. So it's not a rule, you know. And I think that, and given all of this, there are times, certainly times where you can't avoid somebody who may be very difficult and may be having a negative impact and may not be good for you, and you can't avoid them because they're in your place of work, or they're your neighbor, or they're in, their path crosses yours, and in a way that you can't really control. And so, you know, so this is not a sort of an absolute thing. I think, you know, maybe a sort of a general way of thinking of it is just in terms of how do we help ourselves to do what we have been drawn to do in the most effective, expeditious way possible, you might say, given that time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. You know, that when we really, you know, that's why he starts with the preciousness of this human life, so hard to obtain. You know, and I spoke about that the other day, that, you know, we don't actually have forever. We don't even have a chunk of forever. Right? We have some moments in this life, right? And what all of this, it's why I also talked about at the beginning, how does all of this feed into bodhicitta? You know, in order to raise bodhicitta consciously, I mean, there are moments where you may just be taken or seized by, you know, a sort of a being drawn. But when you're more deliberate, what's happening inside of you? What are you reflecting on? What, you know, what's coming in front of you? And what's moving away? You know, what's sort of being elevated in terms of requiring or meriting sort of a seat of respect, and what are the implications of that? That when we contemplate on this path, we're not just doing it, you know, but we're really reflecting on it, then that brings us into contact with ourselves. And this sort of deeper levels of our consciousness and our person and our yearning that prior to practice, we may not have ever sort of been encouraged to actively investigate or even know about or wonder about. We may have had glimpses of it, you know, almost accidents. But to actually, you know, sort of go into that land, you know, and become familiar with it is a big part of the path, because we are going to be challenged. You know, in Thubten Chodron's commentary, she talks about how adversity is an important part of the path. You know, to actually experience difficulty is a necessary and important part of the path. And in our time, that can just seem like, you know, asceticism, right? It's not. It's reality. But then to ask the question, why? Right? So it's not asceticism. It's not just some idea that if you, you know, torture yourself or make things difficult, that somehow that's going to automatically do something. Why is that important? You know, again, what effect does that have in us, on us, in relationship to all of this that we're discussing? So, Joshin, maybe we'll finish with you.
Okay. Can I look at verse 4? Okay. I can't hear you, so I'll start with my question, and then maybe by the time you answer it, you'll come. Okay. So So verse 4 starts with, according to this PDF version, close friends who have long been together will separate. Wealth and possessions gained with much effort will be left behind. So far, so good. I get that. It sounds really hard and awful, but I get it. And I'm down with the journey. Then, consciousness, a guest, will leave the hotel of the body to give up the concerns of this life as a practice of a bodhisattva. And I'm wondering, like, why consciousness isn't the same verse as if it's the same thing as friends and wealth and possessions. And I'm not sure that I'm understanding what consciousness means here. I was using the word consciousness because that one, like, just totally throws me. I'm thinking, yeah, I understand leaving close friends. I understand leaving wealth and possessions. I don't understand losing consciousness. I can't do that.
So can you hear me? Okay. So let me just speak very briefly about this, a cliffhanger to bring us to the next, because I'm going to be talking about this on Sunday. But this verse is talking about the inevitable separation that we will experience from everything, right? Ultimately in death. And so consciousness, a guest, will leave the hotel of the body, right? Because consciousness is just a guest within this body as long as this body and mind persist.
So it's going to death?
So come to the talk on Sunday.
Okay. Of course.
Okay. All right. So we will continue. And I'm sorry if we didn't get to everybody's questions, but we will be continuing this. So and there's, you know, each verse is distinct, and it's also, they're all related. And so the questions likely will be able to come up again in later verses. Okay, so why don't we, shall we finish with the four vows?
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.